Justice with Jax podcast presents this special episode of the American Constitution Society discussion at the University of Denver Stern College of Law of the Armendariz versus City of Colorado Springs case represented by ACLU of Colorado on February 29, 2024.
My name is Nikki. I am 1L board rep for ACS, and this is my first event that I've put together with help from all of our ACS board members. We've got John, Spencer, James, all in the room representing. So we are here with three incredible guests to talk about a case right out of Colorado Springs, an ACLU case that has Fourth Amendment implications with it. For all of you who are studying that or have been studying that in LP or in con law. So I'm going to just introduce our speakers and then let them kind of give some spiels and then we'll go from there. But if at any point you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand, very conversational format. So this is in a different order. I'll go here. Professor Sakharov, who most of you might know, joined the Denver faculty in fall 2022. He teaches or will teach criminal law, criminal procedure, and cybercrime. Professor Sakharov's research focuses on criminal procedure, especially the history of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. He has a particular interest in the history of free trial criminal procedure, including search and arrest warrants, preliminary examinations, and free trial commitment. He also worked as a public defender at the Legal Aid Society in Brooklyn, New York. Big welcome, Mr. Sakharov. Our next guest is Jacqueline Armendariz-Unzueta, or known as Jax. She is a passionate Chicana community advocate and organizer living in Colorado Springs since 2016. She was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. In 2008, she earned her BA from New Mexico State University in Journalism and Mass Communications. Her career experience includes reporting and content creation for corporate and public media, nonprofit sector work, political campaign roles, and public service at the municipal as well as federal level, including 3 years as a Colorado U.S. Senator staffer. And these are very truncated introductions. There are much more interesting facts about each of these people, just so you know. Laura Marat joined the ACLU of Colorado as a staff attorney in fall 2023 after completing a William J. Brennan Fellowship at the ACLU Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. As a fellow, Laura worked on a variety of civil liberties issues, including challenging laws that restrict discussion of race and gender in schools, urging courts to suppress unconstitutionally obtained evidence, and protecting the right to access, use, and record, record public information on them.
That's why I wanted it to put in
mercy. So to start, I will hand it to you, Jax, kind of to give the background of what this case is, how you got involved and pursued the ACLU.
Thank you so much, Nikki, and thank you again to all the ACS folks who put this together with their time and energy. And so, can I do a quick check here? So how many have heard of the case? Just raise your hand. Armendariz versus City of Colorado Springs. I saw one. Okay, I see a couple. Okay, so I was going to ask how many read the complaint. But that said, I would take a minute to state that just because the ACLU of Colorado did some masterful work there. But to lay the context out, I think for this audience, it's important for you to have an idea of the timeline, right? So this case, as the lead plaintiff, right, Armendariz, that's me. I also have a co-plaintiff that's called the Chinook Center, and they're a nonprofit organization that focuses on being an umbrella space for leftist organizations in Colorado Springs. And so some of you probably know the context is social, political, right, that Colorado Springs, largely the elected officials are conservative, Republican. There's the, of course, military culture because of five bases that are there. And so that's certainly a factor here as well. But I would point out that the timeline really begins back in August 2019 with the killing of Devon Bailey. He was shot several times in the back by a Colorado Springs Police Department officer. That was a huge catalyst, and even years later, it shows up as part of this case, frankly. And so that was a moment that really galvanized the community. And so I'll kind of break it down in seasons, summer 2019. And then flash forward, we had February 2020, Trump came to Colorado Springs. People organized to protest. Already the fears about Antifa, right, were in play in the zeitgeist. And then people who had organized and protested started having the U.S. Secret Service show up at their doorstep. So that was relevant for us. And then, of course, you remember BLM summer, right? That started May 2020 with the murder of George Floyd. And with that summer came a lot of conversation, to put it diplomatically, right? Colorado Springs was one of the cities participating in the protests for Black Lives Matter. And so in that time, we then came upon August 2020. That was 1 year since Devon Bailey had been killed. So many of us, myself included, and actually thanks to the ACLU, I learned that the FBI had been watching me sooner than I knew, in one sense, because I had participated in the 1 year remembrance for Devon Bailey. We protested outside the house of the officer who had shot him several times, Sergeant Alan Van Lant. As a result of that, there were actually a couple of federal charges because of some of the people who participated. They had brought firearms. It was messy. And that was another kind of blip on the radar where leftist organizing in Colorado Springs were being targeted. Come to the summer that I was arrested, July 2021. If you remember that month, there was a potential end of the federal evictions moratorium. Many of us who had been organizing for the Black Lives Matter protests, we have alignment and intersectionality, right? We believe housing is a human right. So we held a protest march that happened to be the same day as the sesquicentennial celebration for the city of Colorado Springs. And it was in that moment where CSPD engaged with us as protesters, where I became a figure in this story, so to speak. And the reason is the police had antagonized protesters, and as they were, you know, carrying weapons in full riot gear, one of them had actually charged the crowd and essentially startled me. I dropped my bike, and that was later used as a reason to prosecute me for, I was accused of second-degree felony attempted aggravated assault against a police officer. The bike never touched him. And so I went through the entire legal process. There was no conviction in my case, and I was actually one of six people ultimately arrested for participating in that housing march. There were no convictions whatsoever of any of us. And that's relevant to this case in that those minor crimes were used really as a doorway to opening up us up for targeting because of our political speech and activity. And so, you know, the next notable piece is, of course, the day that the case was filed and why. If I was just arrested for aggravated assault, how does the ACLU come into play, right? Well, what happened when I was arrested was they came to my home and confiscated all of my electronic devices. And you may have caught that at the time, I was a U.S. Senate staffer for the senior senator of Colorado, Michael Bennett. And so that included some U.S. Senate property. And they took those devices to the FBI and made copies of all my data. And so that's where the Fourth Amendment comes to play. I'll let the experts discuss that more further. But I think it's important to give that context because I'll pass the mic here in the interest of time. But if there's anything I want you to take away from today in this discussion, is that this case is a vehicle for addressing a pattern and practice that CSPD has of harassing, retaliating, targeting people who have different political beliefs than seemingly they do. In my case, in particular, the documentation created by the detective who targeted me, he seems to have big problems with people saying white supremacy is domestic terrorism. And so obviously that relates to our First Amendment rights as well. And so this, I thank you for your time today, because this is meaningful for the entire Colorado Springs community. And I think with the involvement of ACLU, well beyond Colorado Springs and Colorado. So thanks for taking a beat to kind of dive into the timeline with me. I know that was a lot of talking.
Over to Laura, maybe, to give us a claims.
Yeah, sure. So I'll kind of pick up where Dex left off and talking more about the search warrants that are sort of the heart of this case. So as Dex mentioned, the CFPD showed up at their house with a warrant to seize all of her devices. That's a lot of information. There's a lot there. After they seized those devices, they got another search warrant to search all of those devices for keywords that included police, cop, pig, protest, human, right, the names of several other activists. And that search was not limited by time, so that would have wrapped in a text that Jack sent 5 years ago with the word protest in it. It also authorized a search of other photos, videos, messages for a more limited time period, but those together really encompass most of what is on all of these devices, including this work laptop, as Jax mentioned. And so a warrant that's authorizing that broad of a search, you would expect to explain where the probable cause was, what was justifying a search that broad. Instead, what these warrants did was describe the t-shirts that the marchers were wearing that said housing is a human right. They talked about how some of the marchers carried red flags, and the detective who drafted this warrant did an internet search and noted that red flags have been associated with communism. The flag that the march is radical and political in nature. It went on to review all of Jackson's social media accounts. There was lots of just social media posts that seemed entirely unrelated to dropping a bike at a housing march. That is the one alleged crime mentioned in the warrant several pages into it, and there's really no discussion of how that alleged crime is tied to any of the information that may be obtained through this incredibly broad search. I'll just mention one of the other... I'll mention one of the other warrants we highlighted in this case, which was for the search and seizure of Facebook data from the Chinook Center's Facebook page. And so, as Jax mentioned, that's really a hub for activism in Colorado Springs. And this warrant authorized the seizure of all of their private Facebook Messenger communications from the Chinook Center's Facebook page, along with subscriber information, Facebook posts, events. So again, an incredibly broad search that's necessarily going to wrap in a whole lot of First Amendment protected activity, speech, and association. And again, that warrant did not make clear how any of that evidence would be relevant to a particular crime. Our complaint also discusses some other warrants from earlier protests, as Jax mentioned, illustrating that this really is a pattern that the city uses to target activists and protesters with these incredibly broad search warrants. So to get to the actual legal claims that we made in this case, we sued the officers who drafted and approved the search warrants for Jax's devices and for the Chinook Center's Facebook data. We sued them for violations of the federal constitution and the state constitution. So the federal constitutional claim is under Section 1983, and it's a claim saying the warrants violated the Fourth Amendment's probable cause and particularity requirement. And also that a heightened standard applies to that analysis because these warrants implicated so much First Amendment protected activity. our claim under the state constitution, which I think we'll talk about a little more later too, is under what you might have heard of as SB 217 or the Law Enforcement Integrity Act. And that claim allows us to bring civil rights actions for violations of the state constitution. And importantly for us, that law makes very clear that qualified immunity is not a defense to those claims. I'll just briefly mention, we also have claims under the Stored Communications Act. We have a Monell claim for the city's custom policy practice of using these overbroad forms to target activists. And then, as Jess mentioned, a claim for injunctive relief asking the Colorado Springs Police Department and FBI to return or delete the copies of access data that they continue to retain for absolutely no reason. I think I'll stop there for now.
Thanks. They retained it for no reason, meaning they might have a reason, but they probably want to research it over time. There is a huge case in New York with which NIS, which I'm sure you know, where the police downloaded the entirety of somebody's phone and devices and then kept it. And then, you know, year after year, they would redo, you know, and the case was gone, but they would keep it and just periodically research all of the data, just, you know, whenever they felt like it, essentially, because it's like, okay, well, we're not to make you feel this, you know. You want, yeah, okay, so, yeah, so the, I guess I'm going to talk a little bit more generally about the problem in this area, both the problem in terms of courts face a difficult conundrum, but also the problem that courts are underprotective of privacy, especially in the Tenth Circuit. The Tenth Circuit has particularly bad, you know, case law. And so the problem is that the, I mean, you do need a warrant. The good news is you need a warrant. Police need a warrant to search a device. And that sounds super protective. But the problem is that both getting the probable cause and then the scope of the warrant end up being very underprotective. So with respect to probable cause, many courts will say, as long as there's probable cause to believe there's some evidence somewhere on the device that relates somehow to the crime, a lot of courts will say that's enough probable cause to get into the device. And it won't, then the, once in, the warrant won't limit it just to the exact areas you have probable cause to believe there might be something. So, you know, in a case like this, if it's an assault, like, you know, it's certainly plausible to say location data that would put you at the place, there's probable cause to believe that evidence of location on the cell phone is relevant to the claim because it just, you know, it shows you're there. But the problem is once there's probable cause to get in, then the warrant will say often, you can look for any evidence of the crime, and you can look anywhere. So I'll just contrast two different approaches to give you a sense of why what's protective and not protective. So not protective is they'll make an analogy to the home. And the idea is we believe there's drugs in the home. So naturally, the police, when they search the home, can search anywhere in the home they might find drugs, which is basically anywhere. They can go in drawers, they can go in filing cabinets, they can go, you know, into upholstery even, they can really go anywhere. And so by that analogy, courts that are underprotected will say, okay, well, we're looking for evidence that relates to this supposed bite-dropping, you know, felony, which is itself a problem, obviously, but it's dismissed. And so, you know, location, mental state, all sorts of things can quickly spin into, we can really look anywhere for almost anything. And the problem when it's not just drugs you're looking for, where you can open a drawer and look and go, okay, that is or isn't drugs. When we're talking about documents with papers, there's no way to tell just by glancing at it what it contains. You have to read it. And if you have to read every document to see if it's relevant, even if it's not relevant, the police have already read it. And so that's a huge fishing expedition problem in this area. And even in the founding era, courts said it's super problematic to have a warrant that allows the government to look through papers, even if they have probable cause to find the relevant paper, they have to read all the other papers to get. And there's some scholarship that suggests that that meant that even with a warrant, you're not allowed to do this because it's going to be over-inclusive in the sense that the government is going to look at all your papers to find the one or two that are relevant. Now, under today's law, that's clearly not the approach. All right, so that's sort of the problem. And one of the leading cases in the Tenth Circuit is Burgess, and it's one of the more permissive ones that the Tenth Circuit law better than me, so there may be updates since then, but it lets things, lets the warrant go pretty broad. The Ninth Circuit, by contrast, and certain districts within the Ninth Circuit take a much more protective approach, and what they'll say with respect to the warrant is that the warrant has to, one, maybe create a separate filter team, so a whole different team than the criminal team that's going to look for relevant evidence. They have to disclaim the right to use, the plain view doctrine, meaning they can't just grab anything else they see for criminal purposes. And they have to give in advance in the warrant a protocol of how they're going to search. Like, here are our search terms. This is how our search terms relate to the crime. Here's the crime. We're going to state it more clearly than they did here. And the magistrate will sign off in advance in the warrant on the search terms and the protocol to make sure they're okay. But in many other jurisdictions, like here, there's no what's called ex ante or beforehand review by the magistrate of the warrant or the search. It's just, here's what you're looking for. I mean, here they didn't even state the crime. I mean, the warrant is really, and the affidavit really are supposed to state with some specificity what the crime is that they're actually looking into, and they didn't even do that. So that even in the Tenth Circuit, hopefully that will be a problem. I know I'm making it seem like their case isn't very strong. The case is extremely strong. I just get depressed by how lenient courts are. And the final thing I guess I'll say is, and as you mentioned, like when it involves First Amendment activity, courts are supposed to be extra rigorous. And they say that, but oftentimes they also throw up their hands and say, well, what can we do? Like, the police have to look everywhere on the device because they might miss something. And the answer is, no, they don't have to look everywhere on the device because, especially on a phone, everything is segregated into its own app. Each app has its own memory. So a good warrant and a good search will say, well, we think that there may be texts within the hour of the event. We will look at texts within that hour, but not do a keyword search across the entire device if that's what happened. And so that's another limit that could be done, but it wasn't here. And, as horrific as this case is, like, don't necessarily get your hopes up, because in some ways the Tenth Circuit law is pretty bad in this area, but I'd be super curious to hear what you have to say to that.
Yeah, so I think we're talking about a couple different things here, and I think a lot of what you're mentioning with like these clean teams or the execution of the warrant really fall more into what happens if you have a warrant that just authorizes the search of a phone or puts some limits on it of how you figure out whether the actual execution of the search complied with the warrant. And I think here what we have is warrants that are facially really obviously invalid and say on the keyword warrant that I mentioned actually says that these keyword searches would be relevant no matter when they're from. So these warrants are intentionally really incredibly broad without justifying that threat in the affidavit. And then I also think some of the Tenth Circuit law, I think it's actually very clear that these warrants did violate the probable cause and particularity requirements in the Tenth Circuit. And I think part of how we know that is because we can see in these warrants, again, it's so clear there's no probable cause linking the actual search to any particular crime. And I think when we're relying on case law that's older, not about digital device searches, the courts don't always, the same logic doesn't always map on neatly to how searches of digital devices work. And so part of what we're doing in this case is really explaining the context of these searches of digital devices and showing that just applying these basic constitutional principles when a search is going to be that broad, showing through everything in a person's phone, which the Supreme Court has recognized is an incredibly sensitive area, in order for there to be that the probable cause for this broad of a search has to be justified in warrant. And there are also like thinking about what the particularity requirement means for digital searches. There are cases that are starting to recognize, like, all right, to have a search of something where it's so easy to see all of this irrelevant information, the warrant needs to be even more specific. It has to identify, what it means to identify the places to be searched and things to be seized. It has to be interpreted in the context of these digital devices that just contain such a vast amount of information.
And if I may, I mean, that's your entire life is on your phone, right? That's part of the concept here. And if anything, what I can lend without being a legal scholar, but play one on TV, is I hope I can humanize this in that we're talking about this overly broad nature of the search warrants, right? Like, I'm the person who lived that, and I'm the one that was left in a blackout after getting dragged to county jail. I'd never been to jail before, straight to a felony charge, right? And so I really want to highlight that is, to me, part of the retaliation piece. My sentiment experiencing interfacing with CSPD and that particular protest and the way this all played out after left me feeling like, we're going to teach you a lesson. Like, sit down and shut up, little girl. Like, we're going to flip your life upside down. Let's be real about the legal system. And is that even the accusation, particularly my profession at the time, right? A U.S. Senate staffer, the accusation in itself was enough to upend my life. And so, if anything, I'm clearly a big fan of the ACLU, was prior, never saw this coming, but on a human level too, reading the complaints, like we mentioned, I was a reporter at one time, I covered crime in courts, like I like FOIA requests, I like reading complaints, I've been there, done that. Again, never thought it would be me to this level, and as I was reading the complaint by ACLU, you know, the, again, masterful work of, which I appreciated, naming that these overly broad search warrants were something that King George once did to harass the revolutionaries who founded this country. So thanks for that comparison, ACLU. But that's it. I think it's time we can open. It's right at the halfway mark, so I'd love to open it up for questions or if there are any other thoughts, panelists. But do we have any questions? Fabulous.
I might have missed this, but do they just not link a warrant to an alleged crime? Like, yeah, I just keep, like, how does that even?
Yeah, so the warrants do, they're, like, in the warrant for the search of tracks of settlement devices, it mentions this state crime of attempted assaults on a police officer.
The previous one that already gone through court, sorry, I didn't.
The
bicycle dropping incident or something.
Yeah, so it talks about the bicycle dropping incident, and then it talks about all of these political issues and social media posts, and then it mentions the state crime and basically asserts that this detective is aware that people who engage in illegal protest activity...
It wasn't illegal, BTW. They just said it.
Exactly, yeah. Both of these warrants repeatedly refer to... to protest activity as illegal, which is also something we've tried to highlight in our briefing. But so the part that's missing is the link between this alleged crime and this incredible amount of data that they're looking to obtain. And so there's statements about how people who engage in illegal protest activity often have their phones with them, and the phones might contain evidence, and people store things on their devices, and people often connect their phones to their laptops. And so, you know, one of the arguments that we're making in response to the defendant's motions to dismiss is that a statement like that, this kind of boiler statement that could apply to anyone, cannot be a reason to conduct this kind of search, because that would essentially authorize a search of anyone, anytime. So we can say, like, oh, people keep things on their phones, so anytime there's any kind of suspected crime, you can just search someone's phone.
Yeah, I think so well said, and it's to me, the word that keeps coming up is danger. Like, it's dangerous, right? Like, we're, this case to me is we're trying to protect our civil rights. We're protecting our first and fourth. We're trying to protect democracy. And if I can highlight to the question, it's like, how, this doesn't even make sense when you hear it, almost. I get that, having lived it. And if I could just highlight, for me, it is one of those absurdity moments, like, laugh to keep from crying. It was the worst time of my life. And reading the arrest warrants, it was wild, because we really leaned into being organized, and that's a big part of how this case, frankly, reached the attention of ACLU. So I had people to share this with, thankfully, and I just remember us, like, pardon my language here, we're all, you know, colored, we're all adults here, but all of us were like, what the fuck? I can't believe this officer wrote this. And the heartbreaking one for me was that there was something to the effect of, in the arrest warrant, that it was clear that I had deliberately attempted to hurt this victim police officer, because I tweet that white supremacy is domestic terrorism. And so because he is a white man, it was clear that I was trying to assault him, which was obviously horrifying to read about myself, because the reality was that I had turned around and I saw CSP dog piling. At the time, I didn't know who, but I remember thinking, is this another I can't breathe moment? Because that was the intensity of the energy and, frankly, the aggression that the police were bringing that day. And in a split second, you know, to me, I'm proud. It just means that I'm not going to look away when people are abusing my community. And that was the reaction, was to drop my bike and be like, you're coming for me? Like, what the hell? And for that 0.3 seconds to lead to this is, you know, something I want to leave you all with as future attorneys, the humanization of what these types of litigation entail as well. So thanks for letting me get on a little soapbox there. But can we take any other questions? Ooh, I see two. Can we, I'm just going to go with whose hands. Red sweater, please.
Mine is more a question of how the ACLU got involved, or like, how did this get on your radar, or like, how did we get here?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because it was actually a bit of a challenge, and I want to acknowledge, and I think this is important to see, that this group is working with ACLU's attorneys have actually been kind of a healing experience to a certain extent for me, because of their high caliber of professionalism toward their clients, because I had some bad attorneys previously. And so they acknowledged, like, hey, we got here later than we would have liked to, but we got here. And that was really important for us. But no one was paying attention when this happened. We got one blip maybe in 2021 from, like, the local alternative newspaper, that the big break was, in my case, we received this body cam, we call it the Alamo body cam, of this dummy dum-dum officer who doesn't turn off his body cam and records himself going to the urinal. So we realized early on that CHPD was trying to withhold this body cam, so we were like, what was on it? And out of six different cases, four in municipal court, two in district court, one of which being mine, right, those six arrests, we're all entitled to the evidence against us. And in my case, the judge actually made, like, a technical ruling that released this body cam, which we then used to figure out that we had been spied on and infiltrated by a CSPD officer, which then led to that local story. but it was quiet after that, and then we got the attention of The Intercept. If people are familiar, it's a good national digital publication, right? Helped Edward Snowden release his documents, and so that's their beat, like this federal level of scrutiny. And so they did a podcast called Alphabet Boys, again, scrutiny on federal agencies, for law enforcement, and we had an episode, and then I think that really kind of broke nationally, and we were in conversations again, but we had approached ACLU, but I wasn't on, another team member organizer was on that beat, so.
Yeah, and that is, so at that time I was working at our national ACLU office, and I found out about this from the podcast, but I think the Colorado attorneys at that point had already been, or were starting to be in communication with you around then. But I'll just say, I mean, in general, like, we want to be involved in cases that really matter for civil rights and civil liberties, and this is a situation, I think Jax has highlighted this a couple times, that the effect that these kinds of warrants have on the Colorado Springs community, and on Coloradans more broadly, like, knowing that if you show out, put in the work, and show up to a protest and take that time to advocate for causes you believe in, that you might be met with these incredibly broad search warrants that'll just dig through anything in your digital devices and go through just incredible amounts of information to see who else are you associating with, who else might be at these protests, what kinds of things have you said about police officers in the past. Like, that has a huge effect on how comfortable people are to express their First Amendment rights. And so for the ACLU, I think this is kind of this is everything we're about. It's, you know, we want people to have all of the rights that they're guaranteed under the state constitution and under the federal constitution.
There's another question. Yes, and I just want to take a beat to say, literally, several people told me, yo, I would have left town. I would have moved away if what happened to you happened to me. Purple shirt.
So, two questions, and forgive me, I haven't read the complaint, but what are their main defenses or arguments justifying this warrant? Because, of course, I hear it, and I'm like, what the crap, you know? And I can't imagine that they're saying, oh, our bad, sorry about that.
Well, they are not saying our bad.
So, how are they defending? And then the second part of the question is, have you seen any change in their procedures or how they handle warrants since this has happened? So I guess even internally, have they learned anything or made any changes to kind of indicate, oh, our bad?
Yeah, great questions. So we are at very early stages in this case. We filed the complaint and all of the defendants have moved to dismiss. So their motions to dismiss are what we have of their arguments, and mostly they're about qualified immunity. They're saying, you know, a reasonable officer would have thought that there was probable cause here. There were protesters at this march. Some of the protesters were arrested. They clearly viewed this protest as illegal. That's not explained why, as Jax mentioned. It's just the warrants repeatedly.
They say so.
They're trained to deal with illegal protest activity. And so most of the motion to dismiss briefing is on qualified immunity. As I mentioned earlier, qualified immunity is not a defense to the state claims. And so far, we haven't seen defendants' arguments about why they think our state claims fail. And we are relying on Colorado law that doesn't always align perfectly with federal law. In some cases, the Colorado Constitution has been interpreted to be more protective of Fourth Amendment rights, especially when there are First Amendment implications. And so we don't have a sense of their arguments there because they haven't really made them yet. They have also moved to dismiss for some other reasons. We're in, besides moving to dismiss, the United States also moved to substitute itself as a defendant for one of the officers in this case, arguing that although he was a Colorado Springs police detective when he wrote the warrant, he was assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and so they're saying he was a federal officer, he was acting within the scope of his federal employment. Therefore, the proper party under for the state constitutional claim under the Westfall Act is the United States, and so they also moved to dismiss on that basis. And right now we're in limited discovery on the issue of whether this particular officer was acting for the sort of federal or state employment. And yeah, I mean, all of their motions to dismiss are on our website, so you're welcome to read them. I think we still think that we have very solid claims. We think it's really clear, not just that the Fourth Amendment and Colorado Constitution were violated here, but that clearly established rights were violated. And so I'm not the one to make their best argument or even for them, but I think we're still in a good spot.
Yeah, and I think there was a part two of that question was, have there been any changes, right? Like, law enforcement, famously transparent about all their policies and procedures, right? So I think that's challenging, and Laura, feel free to add anything. But what I would say as a community member is that, interestingly, I wouldn't say this is the change in the direction we like, but for example, during BLM summer, our city adopted a committee called the Law Enforcement Transparency and Accountability Committee. And it was really a faux kind of just superficial effort, frankly, to answer the call of the moment, right, which is Black Lives Matter and police accountability. And so that was a really disappointing moment for us, frankly, because it wasn't what the community wanted, but it was what the leadership at the time could kind of latch onto. And so the change that I can name and that we've seen is that commissioner committee removed accountability from their name, and now they just call themselves the Law Enforcement Transparency and Advisory Committee. So, like I said, not exactly the direction we've been hoping for, but we do know that we had an impact, because they did that when we, the six people impacted by this most directly, went to them and told them what happened to us. And then the name change happened not too long after. And so there's still work to be done there, but another big change that, you know, in candor, I have not seen it, and I will name it to manifest it. And this is a good segue, unless we have other questions, to SB 217, which is that we've named that this is a pattern in practice from Colorado Springs Police Department. And one of the provisions of SB 217, right, it's about accountability. And now the Attorney General, who I saw several flyers with him in this room today, Phil Weiser, has in his office, has the ability to initiate a pattern in practice investigation. There's been one in Colorado already. It was about the Aurora Police Department. And so, if Phil Weiser is listening to this Zoom, I would like a pattern and practice investigation into CSPD as some of the change we want to see, and addressing a better mechanism than what we have now in LETEC. And so, Laura, do you want to talk about SP2's machine a bit and how this?
Sure. I also just wanted to, there was one other thing in their motions to dismiss that I thought might be interesting to talk about, which was just their. They do make an argument sort of along the lines that these warrants were actually more particularized than required because they listed these keywords and because certain parts of the warrants had date ranges, which I thought was interesting just because in a lot of ways that's kind of antithetical to what we're talking about on the probable cause side at all, to say that, well, like, if we could have just searched the whole phone, which we would dispute, but we went above and beyond by including these keywords to try to limit it, when actually the keywords are clearly targeting associations and political beliefs unrelated to the actual crime, the alleged non-crime. Sure, so on the 217 piece, I think, so one of the reasons I think this case is so strong for us is because we do have all of these different bases for the court to find that these warrants violated Jackson's and other plaintiffs' constitutional rights. And as I mentioned, the Colorado Constitution has sometimes been interpreted to provide for broader protections. And so having this law that was passed specifically to make it easier to hold law enforcement officers accountable, and that explicitly said that qualified immunity isn't a defense, really gives us this alternative avenue for success. And we think, as I said, we think our federal constitutional claims are very strong as well, but I think we do have this entirely separate basis. But again, the defendants haven't really pushed back that much on. One of the motions to dismiss essentially just says, we have qualified immunity under the federal constitutional claims, and for all the same reasons we went under the state constitution as well. And actually under SC 17, that's really not true. That defense just doesn't exist. As courts sort of across the country are changing and the federal landscape changes, looking at state constitutions and making sure that state constitutional rights are protected to the highest degree possible is also something that we're really committed to, and I think this case has the potential to further that as well.
And I would just add one more thing about SB 217, which just personally, I'm not someone who believes in coincidences. And so I hope you'll come visit us at the Chinook Center if you're in Colorado Springs. Because interestingly, that BLM summer, the one like organizing activity that I did directly with the Chinook Center at the time, I really wasn't, strongly connected to the space at the time, was at the 1 year remembrance for Devon Bailey. We created a mural that is now housed there that celebrates SB 217, because we at Chinook Center and we, the community, were being part of that conversation that was happening about police accountability. And so it was myself and another Chinook organizer that brought that project together. And it's been amazing because over the years, it's a beautiful focal point for the space. And, we didn't do that project ever thinking we would be a test case for SB 217 just a couple years later. So that is one of many profound kind of takeaways that I've had with a lived experience of being a civil rights ACLU client. Again, something I never expected, but hold is a huge responsibility for my community.
I have a quick question. Did you have oral argument in this?
Not on the motions to dismiss.
What do you think of the judge?
So our case, the non-dispositive motions have been referred to a magistrate judge. The motions to dismiss are with the district judge, and so those were fully briefed in January, but we haven't had a ruling or any arguments. And actually our district judge changed. We were so we have a new district court judge as of a few weeks ago, a month ago. So I can talk a little bit about the motions to stay, because that's helpful. So that's the one thing that our new district court judge has ruled on. The defendants in this case also moved to stay all discovery pending the resolution of their motions to dismiss, arguing that because their motions to dismiss are based on qualified immunity, and qualified immunity is a defense to suit, not just liability, they should be they're entitled to a stay of all discovery. And the magistrate judge initially denied those motions. Then the defendants filed objections, and the magistrate judge denied those, but then they filed with the district court, and the district court judge did stay discovery pending resolutions of the motions to dismiss. So that's the one order we've gotten from this judge so far. In the meantime, we were given limited discovery into the substitution issue that I mentioned, so we are taking depositions. We got one request for production and a few interrogatories just on that issue of whether this one officer was acting in the scope of his federal employment or his CSB employment.
I have a question. I just want to be mindful of time, and I think maybe a good way to wrap up would be to have you all kind of talk about how you believe the outcome of this case impacts or could impact or interact with other Fourth Amendment issues, either current or future ones. And I'll give it to you, question first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the search terms, as you mentioned, is such a helpful insight into the use of the warrant, really, to have an overbroad warrant that is looking for protected activity and not linked to the crime, because it's hard to see how, you know, searching for human rights is reflective of any crimes. And so that's the giveaway in a way. Like the law, you know, I mentioned Burgess, I don't know if it's still good law, but Burgess is a nice spell spin, but that's a pretty bad case. But these are the facts that can get around it, I think, because it makes clear the motive of the government is to suppress First Amendment rights. So I think that's really going to help, and also makes it just all of the other stuff. It's hard to read this stuff and not intuitively feel like the police are just, you know, abusing the warrant process and not acting in good faith at all. So I am guardedly optimistic that this will turn out both good for this case and also make good law.
I would echo that. I hope we make good law. I just want to protect my community from this type of abuse. And thanks to ACLU for that. Big, big, big assist.
Everyone making it possible. So, I would just add that I think it is important to put really good arguments and facts in front of courts to demonstrate how we have to interpret constitutional guarantees in the digital age. And I think this could be, on the retention issue, for example, there's not a whole lot of case law on how long law enforcement can retain copies of someone's digital data without providing a justification for it or once the case has ended. And I think under constitutional principles, it's really clear that that's dangerous. It could lead to so much abuse, and when there's no justification to retain that data, it should be returned or destroyed. But I think it just, some of these issues just have not come up a whole lot in this context. Our main case for that was out of the Eighth Circuit, and it's about Mike Lindell. And it's an area where there's starting to be cases that we can use and draw from, but one of our main goals with this is to just ensure that constitutional rights are protected even as technologies change and evolve and it becomes easier for police to just get access to so much information and, as Jeff said, to people's entire lives.
Laura, would you mind doing a quick, I think we got like 5 minutes. Another really interesting thing for me is the person experiencing this was the SOMAX element of what we discovered, essentially, like what the FBI was doing during BLM summer and their pursuit of this quote unquote black identity extremism as a cover to really spy on people.
Yeah, I mean, it's always, I think, getting an insight into how law enforcement is trying to target people is always really challenging. As you might expect, they're pretty protective of their methods and the kinds of things that they're doing. But I think, all the activism around this issue has helped bring a lot of that to light. And so, I think we are definitely hoping that ensuring that CSPD knows that they have to follow these constitutional principles in every investigation will incentivize a little more compliance with federal and state constitutions.
Are there any final questions?
I have one quick one. On the looseness of the term of the affidavit reminded me of like the Cop City indictment. So like these people had money shoes, like they must be involved in some kind of domestic terrorism. That prosecution is like very much like it's a partnership between the DA's office and the police. Was that your experience also in the Springs, or how did your criminal prosecution?
Thank you so much for that question. My personal opinion is that absolutely the 4th Judicial District Attorney's Office was complicit in the way that PD was able to target us. But interestingly, again, I would note that, like, two of us were in district court. The other four were in municipal court, different courts, right? And so my experience, and confidently saying there's complicity, is that the process of me going through my felony accusation led to me pleading not guilty, got another charge thrown at me to pressure me more from the DA's office because they knew they weren't going to get the felony assault on me, but then they added obstruction, misdemeanor obstruction or something like that. And I just never thought I would be in a court setting where, for example, I would hear a prosecutor answer the judge with, "I don't know." But that's what happened when the prosecutors kept coming to court saying, like, "We want to withhold this evidence, that body cam I named." And eventually the judge seemed frustrated and was like, "Why? Like, what's your justification under the law?" And the prosecutor said, "I don't know." And that was really startling to me. And it was the moment the judge said, "Well, screw this. Like, she didn't even do like the in-camera review that she could have, right?" And to be perfectly honest with you, I discussed this talking systems, right? I discussed this with the criminal attorney I had at the time. And their assessment was that this judge had more of a business law background. And so it wasn't as tight with the prosecutors and the PD, and was really just looking at it procedurally, and said, "You don't have the justification, DA, to withhold this from the PD, so I'm releasing it in its totality." And that was a major break, the judge doing their job, because that's when, by listening to the body cam ourselves as organizers teaming up, we realized that we had been infiltrated and there was so much more going on. So, yes, it's a whole system that works together. So thank you again. All right.
Okay. We are almost about time, and I wanted to bring up John for, like, after we do a round of applause for our guest speakers. Yeah. Thank you so much for all of you coming to talk with us and share about this really important case, and Jack for being so vulnerable and open with your experience and letting us learn from that, hopefully.